Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kelly Jo, and I am an alcoholic. I was just telling Rhubarb that as I was driving here, I was alone in my car. That's unusual. And, you know, I'm thinking, wow, I try not to think about what I'm going to say when I'm speaking. And I started thinking about it a little bit. And, you know, my mind just gets all cluttered, and I know what I plan isn't going to come out that way anyway. So I turned up the music a little louder, and off we went. And that allowed me to feel God's grace. And whether I'm here, whether I'm at the bedside of a woman who has overdosed, whether I'm trying to find my son who is actively out there, I get this, it feels like someone's sitting on my chest. I feel it right now. And it really scared me for a long time. And, you know, it was not that long ago that I realized what it was. I realized that this is God's grace. It's a gratitude bubble right here. And it always comes out in tears because it really has nowhere else to go. No matter what I'm going through, I am so grateful to be alive and sober. Like, I stand here in amazement because when I made the decision to stop drinking and I surrendered because I just knew that I couldn't go on anymore. I had become a maintenance drinker. I drank from the second I opened my eyes so I could crawl to the shower, put on a really fine suit and some really great shoes, pretend I was going to start a day of work, drank some more, got to my desk, drank some more, started canceling appointments, drank some more, passed out, woke up, drank some more, and did it all over again for 3 months straight. And at the end of those 3 months, I sat in my office and I knew, I got it. This stubborn, tenacious woman, which had done me well in many areas of my life, was certainly not what God was seeking from me. And I got it. I just couldn't believe that I would ever be sober again. I couldn't believe that I would be alive. So I always have to just take a moment and just let you know that there is not one day, whether phenomenal or whether stinky, whether joyous or sad, that I do not get on my knees in the morning and thank God for being alive and sober. And I feel it right now. I was always a little embarrassed to tell my story, because you're not going to sit on the end of your seat in amazement. I haven't suffered severe trauma in my life. I'm just kind of an ordinary Joe. I have two brothers. I'm right smack dab in the middle of two brothers. They have the same birthday, so we're very close in age. They're 3 years apart. And I have to tell you, we had an amazing childhood, an absolutely amazing childhood. There was laughter and music and dancing and family and food and all of that over again. And it was a really wonderful childhood. And when I was 14 years old, I was getting into a little bit of trouble. Actually, when I was 14 is when I had my first drink. We were getting ready to go to a basement party that my girlfriend was having. And I was going to meet a young man that I was going to kiss for the first time. And I was so excited. I was so excited. I used to tell his name, but he might be here someday, so I don't say his name anymore. And one of the girls got a bottle of wine, and that was really dangerous. So we opened it, and, you know, they took a swig, and Andrea took a swig, and Laurie took a swig, and I drank the whole bottle from there. My swig was just a guzzle. Now, I say that not saying that, you know, that's where it began, and, you know, I was off to the races then, because it's just simply not the truth. The truth is that it was the first time I ever drank. That is exactly how I drank that bottle. I passed out. I was very, if I weighed 80 pounds, that was a lot. I never got to kiss Gary. I got sick as a dog and thought it was the most disgusting thing in the world. That's the truth. Got no yay feelings. Wasn't able to do, you know, do or become someone that I wanted to be. It was just awful. That same summer, my father was sent away to treatment for alcoholism. And I didn't even know my dad had a drinking problem. I had no clue. He traveled a lot. His line of work meant that he had a lot of alcohol and planned very large parties for the Bethlehem Steel. So he always had a big suitcase of alcohol when he came home from a business venture. And, you know, when I think back, the only thing I remember my dad saying was that we shouldn't drink the orange juice in the basement refrigerator. It was spoiled. You know, his little stash of whiskey sours down there. I had no clue. I just didn't have a clue. And he wasn't a mean drunk. He slept a lot when he was home. I do know that he fell asleep on the roof one time, and that concerned my mom, but nobody really spoke about it. So when it came that day that I was awakened by my father and Mr. Kilcullen and his boss at the Steel, and I remember seeing him in the kitchen, this shell of a man. And my father's, you know, he's not anymore. He was about 6'4" and rather dapper looking gentleman. That's not what I saw. I saw this skeleton and I was terrified. And then they told me that he had to go away. And then they tried to explain alcoholism to me and my brothers. And I immediately knew he had to be sick because he was my dad and my dad wasn't a drunk. My brothers and I looked at this time in our lives very differently. I wanted to do everything I possibly could to support my dad, my hero. My brothers were very angry, and so we handled it in different ways. And when my dad came back from chit-chat, he sat us down and he told us stories of his family, stories of his father's siblings and parents. And his realization now that they were not horrific drunks, that they too were alcoholics. And probably the only reason that my grandfather didn't drink was because he lived with an entire household of alcoholics. Every one of them died from some aspect of this disease. And my father warned us. He said, you know, this is a genetic thing here. We were teenagers. And he said, you're going to want to start experiencing and take me very seriously that you have a really high likelihood of having this same disease that I have. So I warn you, I caution you, and I will say no more. Well, honestly, when my dad spoke, I really did listen. My lifestyle at the time, I was a dancer. I was fortunate to travel all over and study in Boston and New York City. So my lifestyle didn't lend to a drinking lifestyle, and I was terrified of drugs, so I wasn't about to touch a drug, although dancers definitely liked the dry goods. But I kept hearing my dad, and that was okay. I also remembered what happened when I wanted to kiss Gary. That just, you know, stopped the whole thing. So everything was okay. I can do this. And as we grew, my brothers and I, my brother clearly did not listen to my father and started drinking at a very young age. And I watched this progression. You know, I watched this progression in Kyle, and it scared me. Hi, sweetheart. So Kelly Jo did what she was told. And, you know, I was really fortunate. I got married on my 20th birthday to the man of my dreams. We proceeded, not planned to, but proceeded to have a child and then another and then another and then another. And, you know, life was pretty wonderful. We were financially strapped, to say the least, but simple joy was everything for me and Kevin. And as life progressed, opportunities came along. And as a way to supplement income, I helped a friend who had a financial services firm. He allowed me to work at night so I didn't need to have my children in daycare. And, you know, something just clicked. Something absolutely clicked. Plus, I had had some schooling. And after 3 years of helping him, I ended up becoming a partner and then starting my own firm. And life was really quite amazing. We no longer had the financial woes that we had had, although we really didn't see them as financial woes, because there's something that comes over you when you really work hard for something. You know, and Kevin and I worked really hard for things. We never apologized to our children that we didn't have something or that we couldn't afford something. We used the term that we were on an adventure. And that just takes fear out of children. But things started to change. We made a great deal of money. We bought many, many properties for other people. We made things easy for a lot of people. We did a lot of good for the community. We did a lot of good for charitable causes, all anonymously. And, you know, we really thought we had arrived. And all along, not drinking. I just didn't drink. So I went through, you know, college and marriage and children and all these things that young people can't even imagine going through without drinking, not even thinking of a drink, and having the absolute time of my life. And things just started to change a little. I got very sick. And there is a part of me. I was clearly born with this side. I have a real stubborn streak. And a little bit of a holier-than-thou attitude, she says humbly. You know, I like a challenge. I like a challenge. I like to work for things. I like to earn things. And whatever it was, I always took that on with a vengeance. But something started to happen in me. And it went from joy, simple joy, gratitude, adventure, to putting my own self on a pedestal. And really almost acting as if I was most powerful. The irony in all of this time is my relationship with God has always been there. From a young child, I had a real awareness of God, what I understood God to be. I came from a family of my father's sisters all married Moravian ministers, and we used to listen to them in church all the time. And at a young age, I saw the hypocrisy. I would hear them preach. And then we would go to a picnic, and I would see them behave. And I thought, ooh. You know, it just, something clicked at a young age that I didn't like that. But that didn't mean that I didn't like God, because I knew there was a God up there. You know, I knew you just can't look at the sky, and there can't be a God. And so from a young age, I used to pray. And when my father taught us about this wonderful lifestyle, this 12-step program, which he taught us, you know, one day at a time, let go and let God. These are all things that I heard from the time I was 14 on, and they just made sense to me. And so that helped me. That helped me get through things because I always prayed. The difference was that when my mindset changed, so did my relationship with God change. It was more like, what are we going to conquer today, Lord? As if I was truly sitting next to him and he needed me to help take care of all of you. I believed this. What a sad place to be. I ended up getting very sick, and because I was so tenacious and so stubborn and so powerful, I never went to doctors. In fact, I actually asked my husband to deliver all of our children. That didn't go over well, and he did not do that. But the truth of the matter is I was afraid. I was fearful of doctors and things. So I put on this real, you know, puffed up, feathered attitude and just said I didn't need them. The reality is I was very, very sick with advanced Lyme disease and didn't know it, to the point where my mind was kind of like Swiss cheese. I couldn't walk. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything anymore. So I didn't have a choice but to seek help. Still kicking the whole way. You know, I got the PIC line. I got the antibiotic. Everything's going well. And I almost instantly felt better. I really did. I mean, it took a while for my, you know, to be able to move and for my mind to come back, but I instantly felt better. And once they removed that antibiotic, the PIC line, it was as if I had gone right back. So, not being stubborn, I sought medical treatment. And their suggestion was narcotics for the pain. Well, I knew that wasn't an answer. I knew that wasn't a solution. It was just going to stop the pain, and I needed a solution. And I heard my dad. You have a high likelihood. Drugs, alcohol. Be very careful. So I left and didn't take any prescriptions. A few weeks later did the same routine to a different doctor and the same outcome. And you know, there was a whole lot of despair again at this point. But I had changed nothing else that I was doing either. So I was physically ill. And I was still trying to prove that I was the almighty, the all-powerful. And life quickly started to spiral downward. And we always had alcohol at the office. On a Friday night, it was not unusual for people to come over. We have a patio out back. And, you know, after a good day to partake in some wine and some food and some fellowship. And I just never did. I just didn't drink. Well, I gave in, and I said, why not? And it's incredible that I remember that very first drink. I call it a shishi frou-frou drink. It was a madras. It was cranberry juice, orange juice, and vodka. Actually, I think it was orange juice, cranberry juice, and vodka. And I said to them, oh, my God, just put a little in because I'm, you know. Well, I'm not kidding you when I say they put a little in. And my gums instantly went numb. And, you know, it truly was alcohol entering my body. And because I was so ill, this brought a little hope to me. Like, ooh, I don't feel so bad right now. And, you know, my mindset changed almost instantly. Those shishi frou-frou drinks became my daily drink. And it made sense because I was so ill, and all of my employees knew this. And they were a little like a breakfast drink, so that was okay. Unfortunately, they didn't see me pouring more and more vodka in, foregoing the cranberry, then foregoing the orange juice, and then just hiding the bottle. It wasn't very long. It was maybe 8 months. And I found myself one night passed out in the powder room in my office, having drank a half a bottle of vodka without break. And when I finally opened my eyes, I crawled to the phone and called my husband, and I called my brother, who was now sober, not in AA, but sober. And I asked them for some help. I said, I am clearly abusing alcohol. I am drinking so much because I have so many problems and I need your help. It was clearly all their fault. The problem was they started looking at my drinking. They weren't doing any of the things that I thought they were supposed to do. And we all know how this goes. What a great reason to drink more. I'll show you. You know, I'll show you. And unfortunately, it spiraled down more. I ended up around that time going to the Steel Hall, my father's home group, for 36 years. And I had called my dad in Florida and I said, "Dad, I am really abusing alcohol. I need a little help. And I know this place helped you." I had heard him speak a few times and on his anniversary. And so he made some phone calls and there were people waiting for me. And I went in and I felt great walking in there. But I didn't feel like any of you had any clue what I was going through. You know, you just didn't know. You certainly didn't have my problems. All the same thoughts, you know, the area of this disease where we are not unique. So I left and I didn't come back for a while. I attempted to do this on my own. And darn it, didn't everybody give me a reason to drink again? Because they just didn't listen to me. No one would listen to me. And, you know, I used to say unfortunately, but I will say fortunately, alcohol in my body is, it's dynamite. I ended up with a DUI. My name all over the papers, clients everywhere, knowing what was going on. And it was the beginning of the worst before it got better. Fortunately, my body is dynamite when it's mixed with alcohol. Because I have to tell you, I can't even imagine if I had started drinking when I was a teenager. I can't imagine that I would have survived my teenage years. Or if I did, if I had been able to continue to binge drink as I had started, to live in that hell. So I see God's grace is that although I was born an alcoholic, there is no doubt in my mind. I just didn't know it because I didn't drink. God's grace was that he taught me quickly, and my stubbornness allowed me to see that, my tenacity. I thought I kept asking people to help me. I thought I was letting them know that I couldn't do this. But, you know, if I actually came out and said, "I need help," that would make me look really weak. And Kelly Jo was not weak. You know, after all, I was helping God help all of you. So I had to try to use little innuendo, and it had gotten to the point where I was literally done. I knew that if I stopped drinking, I was going to die. I had already experienced seizures. But I was okay with that. I had a little chat with God, and I actually had called my dad, asked him to pick me up at the office. I said some horrific, evil things to him. I was not a nice drunk. I was an evil drunk, which is why I stayed in my office, because I couldn't stand to be in my own skin. How could anyone else stand to be around me? And I told him I was going to stop drinking and that I was probably going to die. And aren't you lucky that you had people that cared about you to whisk you away? You know, just really ugly, nasty things. So the next morning, when I awoke and there was not a drop of alcohol anywhere, my husband was out of town. My children were off to school, although I certainly didn't help them get there. My two youngest sons, I laid in bed and I just prayed and I thought, "Okay, God, you know, you're going to take my life because I can't last long without alcohol. If you don't forsake me, Lord, I promise I'll listen." But if you're trying to teach a lesson to, I don't know, my children, my siblings, my husband, of how serious this is, that's okay, but just please, Lord, let me get down to the basement and hide behind the furnace because I don't want my sons to find me. And I was okay with either decision he made as long as he could help me down to the basement. There was no possible way I could get there myself. I was so sick. And honestly, like a knight in shining armor, my dad appeared at my bedside with my mom, bag packed. And we were off to treatment. You know, one of the problems when I went to Steel Hall the first time, and I really did want help, and I'm sure that in the back of my mind I knew that I was an alcoholic. One of the problems was that when I was listening to a speaker, I couldn't relate to anything they were saying. They talked about Drunkalog. They talked about all this different stuff, and I couldn't relate because the insanity where my life was at that point was so far worse than what I was hearing, and I was so ashamed. I was so ashamed. I share that I used to put bottles, I would neatly cut out the bottom of my purse, the lining, and make it so that the bottles could fit perfectly in there. Then I had to move to cartons because if you put your purse down, you could hear the clink. And I have to be honest, I wasn't worried about people hearing the clink. I was worried about it breaking and not having any alcohol. That's just the truth. So then I had to go get cartons, and I got cartons that would fit, so I'd stitch it a little more. I'd spend hours doing this. And then that little top on that wine that clicks, it's like the telltale heart. It's just that loud. I could swear everyone in the whole world could hear when I was opening that wine. I was going insane, but I wasn't hearing the insanity. I was so ashamed. I was hiding bags of wine in the grocery bags that we saved in the closet above the garbage and cutting a little hole and letting that spout come out. So I didn't have to click anymore, and I didn't have to get a glass, and I could just put my head under it. These are the things I was doing, and I didn't hear anyone else doing such absurd, insane things. So I truly had to be really, really bad. And I share those few things with you simply as a way of relieving myself of that shame and letting you know that I understand how insidious this disease is. How cunning, how baffling, and how powerful. So if there's anyone new here and you're doing some really crazy things, you really belong here, and I hope you come back. Oh. When I was in treatment, I remember there were about 100 of us. And one particular lecture, they said that 4% of you are going to leave this building and stay sober. And I just couldn't even believe it. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. 4%? Who would ever pick up a drink again? I was just so grateful that I didn't have that alcohol, that I didn't need that alcohol to breathe, to pee, to do anything. And I thought, while I was sitting in that chair, I prayed. And I said, God, please, I can't even imagine the day will come where I will think of picking up another drink. But if it does, please, like, smack me, do something, make me aware. I just can't even imagine. And I feel as if I'm sitting in that chair. Because I was still very sick, but I had gone days without alcohol, and I was so grateful. And I'll tell you, I really did believe that the problem was the alcohol. And once I got that out of my system, everything was going to be fine. I only drank for a little less than 3 years. From beginning to that insanity was less than 3 years. And so we move forward, and Kelly Jo leaves treatment, and not much changes. I come home to an absolutely flourishing business at a time when it should have, you know, been shutting down. That's where the market was. A flourishing business. I had bills to pay. We had people to take care of. And but I vowed to do what I was told. My thinking just started to go backwards again, though. You know, it just started to go backwards. I was going to meetings. I hadn't found a sponsor yet. I was looking for the perfect sponsor. And, you know, just some really old thinking. And I was in the office. And I prayed again and just said, God, I need a sign. I absolutely need a sign where you let me know if closing this business is what I need to do, because I'm sober, but I don't feel happy. I am not happy at all. I just don't know what to do because I have debts to pay, and if I don't have my business, I can't pay my debts. And, you know, I chuckled a little with God because that's what I do. And I went home. The next morning, I happened to be driving by the front of my building, and my sign, which was professionally put in, cemented in the ground 10 years ago, was laying or was leaned up against the tree. And I pulled over and I called my husband and asked if he knew why the sign was against the tree. He had no clue. I had attorneys renting for me. I called them and said, "Do you know why my sign is against the tree?" And this one gentleman, David, said, "Oh, Kelly Jo, yesterday around 4 o'clock, I went out front to go get pizza, and your sign was face down on the ground." And, you know, people think this is really silly, but I share this because this is yet again God's grace. Around 4 o'clock is when I was praying for God to give me a sign, like a real sign. "I need you to come down here, Lord, and show me." And so David started telling me this, and I just started to cry. I just started to cry. And he proceeded to tell me then that the wood had rotted above the cement and the wind. And, you know, he gave out the whole reason as to why it came down, and he picked it up and put it against the tree. And, you know, there was a part of me that started to listen to him in doubt. And I thought, "Oh, my God, Cal, seriously, you prayed. Your prayers were answered. Now call your man and see if he's on the same page." And I did. And he wept with me. And we closed our business. And chaos ensued. About a month later, when I started to make phone calls to people to let them know that I was going to have to let some of these properties go, a difficult thing to do, it was a rather trying day, and a banking friend of mine had come to visit to see how I was, you know, as I hung up the phone from my last call, I was drained and I was humiliated because I'm a woman of my word. I believe that I made those debts. I should pay them. But I was okay then. And this gentleman said to me, "Kel, are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, you know what? I'm okay. I'm okay. It's really humiliating, but I'll be able to give back in another way." And he said, "No, I don't mean that. I don't mean the money." He said, "You want a drink?" And I looked at him and I said, "Oh, my God, Jay, I didn't even think about a drink. Wow." And he left and we hugged and I got in my car and I'm turning the bend. And the first thought that came through my mind was, "You didn't even think about a drink. Maybe you're not an alcoholic." And I swear to you, I could feel God go right across my head. That moment came to me. When I was sitting in treatment, that moment came to me when I said, "Who could ever even think that they don't have a problem again?" These are the little blessings that have continued to happen to me that I am now, thank God, paying attention to. I am now paying attention to once again. It got really difficult. You know, it got really difficult, and I had to do some humbling things, as did my husband. But I will tell you, that Kevin and I and our children are experiencing an even greater simple joy than we did when they were so young and we didn't have any financial means. I caused a lot of chaos in my husband's life, too. I absolutely held him hostage. This wonderful marriage that we had, this partnership, this team, I became the evil master. And I caused a whole lot of pain in my household, even though I didn't go home. And I was so angry that he let me suffer. I was so angry that he didn't leave the house with the boys. I was so angry that he just didn't see that I needed so much help. And I held that anger for a very long time, even after treatment. And, you know, then I started to experience this program and I started to experience working with a sponsor and really shutting my mouth and listening to God. You know, I talk to God a lot. I pray a lot, but I find it's often more important for me to listen to God. And, fortunately, Kevin took my advice when I needed to step away from him and said, "You need some help, baby, because you've got to find this joy. And if you don't, unfortunately, I don't think our marriage is going to last because I can't go back there. I can't ever go back there. So please, I don't want to do it for you. I don't want to take the reins. you know, please find your own happiness. And God willing, you'll forgive me for the chaos that I have created. And, you know, yet another blessing. My husband, although it took a while and I didn't interfere, he thought himself worthy of finding the same peace. And he's an avid Al-Anon member. He is happier than I've ever known him to be. And not because I make him happy, not because the children make him happy, but he now also has a relationship with God that I have never experienced in him. And, you know, so I come to you this evening, not with a flamboyant story. It's actually pretty dull. And for a while I was ashamed. I kind of thought I was a spoiled brat, that I was an alcoholic, because there was no reason that I picked up a drink. I wasn't trying to hide trauma. I wasn't trying to hide from somebody I wanted to be. It just wasn't like that. And I would hear people that had suffered such atrocities. And to me, back then, it made sense that they would seek a drink or a drug. So how dare I? But you know what? Once again, I've listened. And as I said, an ordinary Joe with a very serious deadly illness called alcoholism. Since I've closed my business, we did a lot of soul searching and a lot of research and a lot of looking around. And I am just so fortunate to say that I now spend my every waking and sleeping hour, as does my family, with women in recovery. And is it odd to be grateful that you're a recovering alcoholic? It is truly the greatest blessing that God has bestowed upon me, and my husband, and my children. They have more courage and insight and gifts that they give to me than I could possibly ever give to them. So my message tonight is that of seeking a God of your understanding. That truly is where it all begins. He's listening. He wants us to come to him. He puts things in front of us specifically to see if we are going to reach for him. He does not want me to be godlike. He does not want me to be equal to him. He wants me to be human. He wants me to err. He wants me to be sad. He wants me to seek him when I'm feeling that way, because he can take it all. And I walk into the rooms. I don't care if it's here, this fabulous place. What an amazing place to have a meeting. I was in New York on Saturday night celebrating a year with one of those women that came to live with us for 6 months. She is phenomenal, and she is working with other women. And I spoke in Long Island. And when I walked in that room, it's as if I walked here or in the Steel Hall or in Aruba or wherever I go. I just get so excited to go to a meeting because I just get this gratitude bubble, this feeling like someone's sitting on my chest, when in reality it's gratitude with nowhere else to go. So I start to cry. And I come to you humbly this evening to let you know that I am so grateful that I am alive. I am so grateful that I am sober. Because without those, the gifts that I have received from this would absolutely not be possible. And I know we have 10 more minutes to go, but I really don't have more of a message than that. And so I thank you very much for letting me stand.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.